Hello, everyone. Welcome to a very special episode of Uncanny Treks. We are continuing our long march through some of the Al Ewing Avenger series. We are up to the end of Ewing's Ultimates run. We are looking at Ultimates 2, Volume 2, numbers 1 through 9 and 100. Again, Matt, that's Ultimates 2, Volume 2. It's the second series called Ultimates 2.
It's very easy to Google.
So it's collected in two trades. The first trade is Volume 1, Troubleshooters, which is issues 1 through 6. And then the second trade is called Eternity War, and it is issues 7 through 9 in issue 100. Al Ewing writes all of it. For most of the art, the art's Travel Foreman. Did you have any familiarity with him, Matt?
I did not.
He's apparently a Hawaiian guy. He's worked on Immortal Iron Fist with both Brubaker and Matt Fraction, then also with Dwayne Swarovski. And then he's worked on a little bit of Jed McKay's Black Cat, too. He also did, I don't know if you remember the Jeff Lemire Animal Man from the New 52.
I did read that. He was the artist on that.
He was the main artist on
it. That was some crazy art. On Animal Man, there's a lot of blood and meat in that book. It's awkward.
A lot of flesh.
That's why I stopped reading it. It was gross.
Yeah.
Is the Immortal Iron Fist worth reading?
Oh, hell yeah. The main artist with Brubaker and Fraction on Immortal Iron Fist is David. But Foreman does some fill-ins on the Brubaker and Fraction run, filling in for AHA. There's some other artists who fill in, too. And then he's the main artist for the sequel to Dwayne Swarovski. Foreman's the main artist for that. I love that Immortal Iron Fist comic. It's one of my favorite comics. At some point in the future, I'd love to talk about it.
Well, Bob, the name of the volume is called Troubleshooters. When we last left the Ultimates, we were introduced to a new team of characters neither of us have ever heard of.
I didn't look them up, Matt, but I assume they're new. Are they new to this series?
I'm pretty sure they were, and they do play a significant role. Well, not really a super significant role, but they're in this book. And when I was introduced to them, I wasn't quite sure how I felt with them replacing these other established characters we already had. And as someone who liked Avengers World, Bob, you know how I feel about brand new teams. And this was not one I cared for, though.
Oh, Matt, I have to agree with you on this. Still, this is a great series, and I enjoy it quite a lot, but I didn't have a lot of time or interest in the Troubleshooters. Honestly, when I was putting the notes together for this episode, I tried to avoid talking about the Troubleshooters as much as I could. I mostly successfully did avoid talking about them because there's just not much to say, listeners.
They're who the Avengers get to beat up at one point, and or they're that part of the plot.
Basically, they're psychic soldiers for the U.S. government. I was also trying to basically avoid talking about this character as much as we could, but we wound up having to talk about him a little at the end of the last volume of Ultimates. That's a Philip Nelson Voigt, who's the George Smiley looking, the Gary Oldman looking guy, who's a faceless bureaucrat.
In the last episode, Bob is like, I have absolutely no interest in this guy and don't care about him. And as I'm reading Ultimates 2, I'm like, dang, Bob, they filled you in. It's right there. There's a whole origin story to this guy. Have fun with that.
In a way, it's a testament to how much I like Al Ewing and what a good writer Al Ewing is, that even with these characters who I just could not care less about, I still ultimately find these issues interesting to read, even though I'm just indifferent to the Troubleshooter.
Yeah. There's nothing special about the Troubleshooters either. I didn't really think any of their antics were that interesting, but it is what it is.
It's almost like Ewing's trying to do a Wildstorm team because they're superheroes and superpowered psychics, but they, for the most part, don't really have strong superhero gimmicks or strong superhero costumes.
That's exactly what they are, Bob. They don't follow that traditional superhero look you would have expected from an Avengers book.
It's funny, listeners, because this might come out a bit after this, but we just did a huge issue where we were debating Al Ewing's Mighty Avengers versus Nick Spencer's Avengers World, which Matt was more of an Avengers World partisan. I was more of a Mighty Avengers partisan. On that episode, I dogged the new international superhero teams that Nick Spencer introduced in Avengers World. I dogged them pretty hard. I don't like them very much. But I got to say, both his Eurotrash Avengers and his Chinese Avengers, way, way better than his American government Avengers that Al Ewing brings up in this book. So Matt, you can take a victory lap on that if you want.
I'm good with that, Bob. I mean, I'm not that tuned to those Eurotrash Avengers or the Chinese Avengers.
One other question I did want to ask, Matt. So who do you think is worse? Do you think the children of the Avengers that we see in Avengers World are worse, or do you think the Troubleshooters are worse?
At least with the Children of the Avengers, I have some idea of like how there's supposed to be some interconnectivity to everything else. The troubleshooters arrive, and then I'm pretty sure this is probably the last time we see them after this book.
I would have to assume, although maybe they show up. Listeners, we've decided we're not going to cover Al Ewing's New Avengers AIM. We were just not feeling it, and we didn't think we would get a very interesting podcast off of it.
There's not a lot to talk about when you're reading it, so that's why it would not make for good podcasting, honestly.
It also requires, it maybe doesn't require, but I think it would reward in-depth knowledge about the Young Avengers, which neither of us have.
Correct.
I would say, Matt, I maybe slightly prefer the troubleshooters to the Children Avengers that came up in Avengers World, but I don't feel strongly about it. I could see your perspective on that as well. To plunge into it, so like we said, Volume 1 is Troubleshooters. That's issues 1 through 6 of Ultimates 2, Volume 2, which I'm never going to get tired of saying. And I guess to start out issue one, Matt, I wanted to take a guess at your favorite panel, and you can correct me, but I was thinking on page 11 in issue one, where we see Black Panther go undercover as yuppie scum to meet with Captain Marvel. And Captain Marvel is really bad at this whole disguise thing, even though she has a past as a spy. She's really bad at it. Whereas Black Panther is amazingly credible as yuppie scum. I thought that might be your favorite.
It's funny because T'Challa here at the beginning, he literally looks like Clark Kent. And even Captain Marvel points that out. He's got that look to him for his disguise. You can tell while reading on the page, he's supposed to have a bit of a different accent than he would usually have. I think
they do a good job expressing that in his word choice.
Exactly. Yeah. He doesn't sound like T'Challa.
Undercover T'Challa and undercover Carol Danvers are pretending that they're on a Tinder date or some internet date. So undercover T'Challa conversation is to talk about the first season of Stranger Things.
What I do like, though, Bob, is on page 13, you have that scene of Captain Marvel talking to Black Panther that you hated from the previous issues. It's still the same looking at the camera. It's still there.
I actually mind it a lot less here because I think I'm looking at the panel you're talking about.
Yeah.
And it is Captain Marvel looking at the camera, but you're looking over Black Panther's shoulder in the foreground.
So Bob appreciates because you see T'Challa's, like, you can see that she is actually talking to T'Challa and you're not fooled like you were in the book and that she's talking to you.
I'm willing to forgive one page of direct address, but when you're doing two or three pages of direct address, that's when you're getting too far, in my opinion.
But we really needed that flashback here, Bob, didn't we?
We did. It is one of these interesting things, and we've seen Ewing have to do this with two different series, right? Of both in Captain America and Mighty Avengers 1, and now in Ultimates 2, Volume 2, Number 1. He's having to relaunch his series, and A, it be the same, but B, it be different enough to justify the new series. And it's funny to watch him navigate that, because like with Cap and the Mighty Avengers, as I recall, it was basically he did a lot of the same beats from Mighty Avengers 1, but he just did them in a different way. Whereas in this, he's just doing it with more flashbacks and references.
You do get flashbacks. Remember, Galactus is now the Lifebringer. We met the Infinaut, who I still don't have a clue what that character's thing is.
I don't either, but we'll get to him. Yeah. We'll get to him. Then the ending of Ultimates, right, was the U.S. government and Philip Nelson Voigt decide that the Ultimates are too powerful and have to be disbanded, right?
Right. And they didn't like that. They were not happy. And if they do get back together, they're going to have to send in the troubleshooters.
Exactly. Well, Matt, one other thing I wanted to ask you about this issue was a motif in this issue is characters asking other characters, what do they dream? I was wondering if you had a favorite reveal of a dream. I thought it might be on page 15. We see Carol Danvers, what does she dream? And we see it. Cool half and half panel where I'm not sure if it's the Hand of Eternity or probably it's the Hand of the First Firmament who we'll meet later, but
correct,
is dreaming this hand reaching out to her.
If you go back a page to page 14, I appreciated Black Panther's dream because that is some huge foreshadowing for what happens at the end of this book.
Oh man, you're right, I didn't even catch that. And the way that the cat's eyes are drawn on that dream panel on page 14, that's really awesome,
really cool.
Matt, one other thing I wanted to ask about Black Panther to set up our conversations for the rest of the series. You mentioned how yuppie T'Challa looks a lot like Clark Kent, but did you notice how strongly Al Ewing was writing Black Panther as if he was Batman in these issues?
There's a lot of scenes throughout the issues where T'Challa doesn't actually enter the fight. He's analyzing everything. All he needs is a cape and he'd be Batman. That's what it boils down to. You can tell he's thinking through what's happening. And I like that. It's more he has an analytical mind and he's thinking, is it really Batman or is it more...
A couple other things too, though.
Because like, he has strategy, but Batman usually he will act rather quickly, whereas T'Challa, you can tell he's stopping to think. You don't really see that as often with Batman.
I do think you're right that that's an interesting contrast. And honestly, it's something I'd like to see future Black Panther writers use more of having T'Challa being more passive until he's ready to act.
Right.
It's like a really cool way to portray him. I wonder if that's even maybe reflects Panther hunting habits or something. Maybe it doesn't, but it's a speculation. The other things I would say that make Black Panther feel very Batman-like to me, especially in this series and a bit in the other series too, is we see the mastery of disguise, which is a big Batman thing. Then there seems to be a real resentment of Black Panther, definitely from Captain Marvel and also maybe from Spectrum and Miss America, although I'm less sure about that, but most pronounced from Captain Marvel. The resentment you see from Captain Marvel and maybe from the other ladies on the Ultimates a little bit does seem Al Ewing's resentment about the overpowered way writers sometimes write Batman.
One of my favorite panels is on page 18, where you see T'Challa, he's throwing energy daggers at Anti-Man, the new Herald of Galactus or whatever, and they don't do anything. But him saying out loud what he's doing is so not Batman to me. But I do think this scene is awesome. You can also tell, though, he's learned from what's happened, because he's interesting. He's thinking... Yeah. Whereas Batman, I don't think, would do that. It would just be a silent page where he's, oh, it didn't work, do something next.
In that way, definitely Batman is just more of a detective and fighter, whereas T'Challa is a scientist and a ruler, first and foremost, and he's a fighter only to serve those ends, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Well, Matt, we get to the cliffhanger of this issue, and the cliffhanger of this issue is that not Black Panther, not Captain Marvel, but Miss America is going to lead the reformed version of the Ultimates, and they are going to team up with Lifebringer Galactus and his herald Anti-Man, and this issue is called Q-Title, What Do You Dream?
What Do You Dream? And we found out what they dream, and it was good foreshadowing.
It was very good foreshadowing. So in issue number 2, Matt, my guess at your favorite panel was on page 6, where the Living Tribunal asks Galactus how he pleads to the charge of distorting reality.
And he's all, not guilty.
We get the trial of Galactus by the Living Tribunal and Master Order and Lord Chaos, right?
Yeah, you really got to stretch your brain here, folks. I've said this before in the other Ultimates. When you start getting these cosmic beings, what you're looking at on the panel is almost meant to be like a metaphor. We will get to a line later that I love. It's my favorite panel in this whole series. But this starts out in my mind. I always have to remember what I'm visualizing isn't necessarily what is intended. It was actually happening. It's meant to be metaphorical. It's weird to explain, but you're seeing the living embodiment of order and chaos, the Living Tribunal itself, and then Lifebringer Galactus all coming in as one, and it's insane.
Honestly, I found this one fairly easy to track, but to be honest, some of the conceptual entities we meet in later issues, it loses me. In part, it's not because I'm so smart or anything. It's just I'm familiar with Living Tribunal and Master Order and Lord Chaos. You're exactly right that they are concepts and you have to think of them as concepts. But there's also the way in which they are just comic book characters. And it's, okay, they're the comic book characters. I know their deal and I can process what they're doing.
I'm going to read aloud one of the, at the beginning of all these comics, they give you a recap of what's happened. And it's usually through one of the characters telling you. There's one specific one that I read to myself, and I can't believe my brain understands this.
There's other Al Ewing comics we might look at in the distant future that explore this. Comics do have this weird thing of they literalize and they visualize metaphors. There's also, when you add on the weirdness of superhero continuity on to that visualized metaphor, it's interesting and heady brew.
Well, on the final page of the...
One other thing, this is skipping ahead, and I was originally going to skip over this character because I didn't fully understand his deal, and it didn't seem like he matters, but he does come back later, so I'll just note it. In issue number 2, we see the Shaper of Worlds for a bit, and he's going to show back up later, but I don't really get the Shaper of Worlds deal, but he started out as a Hulk villain, then he later became more of a cosmic character, and... He's not the only character from this run, but he does have some role in the Dan Slott, Mike Allred, Silver Surfer run that helped set this up. And that is a really good run at Silver Surfer Comics, and we should look at it at some point in the future.
I didn't really get the Shaper of Worlds thing. I understood what the idea was, but I don't understand how he plays into the bigger scheme of things until later on.
honestly, I don't really understand his deal very well. Yeah. Those are my only two points of reference. It's Hulk villain, and he was in the slot already, Silver Surfer, but I don't remember how they used him.
But if you don't get his deal, Bob, don't worry, because on the final page, you've got Lifebringer Galactus watching both Order and Chaos kill the Living Tribunal with their scary laser eye things. So,
yeah. And it's funny because this is also a Christmas issue, right?
Yeah.
So the climax is Master Order and Lord Chaos basically behead the Living Tribunal with energy rays. Then we hit the Q title and to all a good night.
I also don't understand how this affects anything on a cosmic level. Does this affect humans in any way when the stuff's going down? I don't know. When Chaos and Order are killing the Living Tribunal in front of the Lifebringer.
That's an interesting point.
They have effects on things that would affect people, so I don't understand why, but it's insane. It's just insanity when you look at it.
Yeah, it seems like eventually it will, right? Which is why
they're trying to stop it.
Has to try to stop it later in the thing. But yeah, it is interesting. Tribunal's death might not have immediate effects just because the Tribunal's goal, as I understand, and this might be totally wrong, but as I understand the Tribunal, his purpose is to maintain balance more than anything else.
Right. Now, Order and Chaos are out of control, so I feel like that could have been a great crossover if they really wanted one.
And I'm glad they did. Yeah, it does seem with Order and Chaos running wild, you might see your tie-in of Order and Chaos chasing civilians down the street.
Yeah. Or whatever. Exactly.
Moving on to issue number 3, Matt, my guess at your favorite panel was going to be 9 and 10, where Galactus hurls Anti-Man, his herald, away to save him. And Lord Chaos remarks as Galactus does this altruistic act, "This is not the true devourer."
Okay, I did like that, but on 10, Galactus turning back to the purple, to the devourer, and you see you can see his arm becoming purple. That I thought was cool, because that's such a representation. It's only he's slowly turning back. He's like, "No, don't want this to happen." And he doesn't lose his Lifebringer abilities. We'll say that.
And him holding up the hand really does look, he has the purple arm that would be his devourer arm instead of his Lifebringer arm. It looks like the Infinity Gauntlet.
Yes.
It looks like he has a disease on his arm.
Yeah, holding it like there's something wrong with him. I like the way that's portrayed here.
No, that's good.
Definitely not, though, the next page where the troubleshooters show up with the star thing and that whatever that character is in the background, I don't like that design. It looks like he's wearing a bikini.
Yeah, it's very strange. I've come to like Anthony Bowens, but that costume is even worse than Anthony Bowens' five-tool player costume.
It's rough looking. And that character does place his significance later on, but forgive me for not even remembering the name.
The page Matt's talking about is the troubleshooters show up in Blue Marvel's underwater headquarters, and they figure out that Blue Marvel is not there and not on Earth, and most of the other Ultimates are not on Earth. This has all been provoked by T'Challa and Carol Danvers leaving a meeting at the same time, which made Philip Nelson Vought suspicious, and so the troubleshooters are realizing that the Ultimates are back together.
I do like, though, that Blue Marvel's headquarters has some form of Siri where they can ask if people are in the building, and it shows up on the screen. Or like, where they're... Hey, Siri, where's Monica Rambeau?
You'll need to...
Oh, my bad.
It's dangerous to do that when you're dealing with cosmic concepts.
Exactly, because it calls forth people.
It does call forth people. Well, speaking of summonings, that does bring us to the cliffhanger where Master Order and Lord Chaos show up to confront a guy who I think is their creation and another mediator figure, the in-betweener. And basically, Master Order and Lord Chaos show up and they kill the in-betweener, merge with him. Together, I guess all three of them become a new entity, Logos, and this hits us up for the title, Q title, Bad Moon Rising.
Oh, Bad Moon Rising. And Logos looks like something straight out of Final Fantasy VII or something. I'm pretty sure that Final Fantasy VII has the same idea with the fighting metaphor psych team we talked earlier about.
Oh,
and,
interesting.
Because the main character is Sephiroth, and he's humanoid looking throughout the game, but then at the end becomes the cosmos and everything. This has helped me understand that, because this design for Logos really looks like something that he turns into in Final Fantasy. Which, oh, wow. I just put that together.
I know nothing about Final Fantasy, but it makes real sense to me that Ewing might be taking influence there and kind of remixing it.
I could totally see, like, Cloud hitting this thing with a buster sword. All right.
Yeah. So moving on to issue number 4. So we get another character from Dan Slott and Mike Allred's Silver Surfer run here. This is the Never Queen, or the Queen of Nevers. I like Queen of Nevers more. It's a little more poetic. And so the Queen of Nevers is confronting, and this is my guess at your favorite panel, Matt, on page 6. The Queen of Nevers is confronting Logos over his murder of the Celestials. I thought that was a really cool image.
It really was. And throughout the beginning of this issue, they mentioned the Celestials get destroyed.
Or at least most.
Yeah. And then one is kept safe, the last Celestial. And this is where I started to lose things, because I never quite grasped the concept of the Celestials. Even though there is a history piece here that's kind of shown that they become dark Celestials. And you start to lose it there. But if you're reading this, folks, if you haven't read this yet, when you get to that part, don't give up. I promise you. It gets confusing once they do introduce the character of, what's her name? The Never Queen.
Yeah, the Never Queen, or the Queen of Nevers. I think it is somewhat confusing, but I think Ewing and Foreman do a good job of making the issue really readable despite clutter.
Like it says in her caption, she's the personification of what might be. So what could come.
I don't know if you noticed this. It took me a while before I noticed it, but did you see at the end of the letter columns how Ewing has like recommended reading?
No, I did not see that. That is something I really should have looked at.
Yeah, it's interesting. I didn't notice it till I was like halfway through the series. And some of the recommended readings are callbacks to specific issues of the prior Ewing Ultimate series that he's building on. And some of them are talking about characters' first appearances or earlier appearances. Later, some of them are more just about crossover tie-ins. Or at one point, he's, hey, this is Captain Marvel's new series. And hey, this is Miss America's new series. But that was where I already knew the Queen of Nevers was from the Slott run. But then I saw that he had a recommendation to read a particular issue of the Slott run with the Queen of Nevers, and maybe one for the Shaper of Worlds, too. Another cool thing was with these Celestials, and yet later, I don't think we're going to talk about it much for the podcast, but he also brings in Dark Celestials. And I'd forgotten this, but that's apparently a throwback to Matt Fraction and Terry Dodson's Defenders run in about 2011. That's a very cool series that in the distant, distant future might be worth us looking at, too.
Once we hit with the Celestials, I'm going to start losing what's going on. But I do like the placements. I do appreciate the Celestials when they uncover them like they did with the X-Men stuff. You know, when you had one in San Francisco sitting in the park. I thought that was awesome. That kind of stuff I get. But this kind of stuff,
that never pays off satisfactorily, but it's a cool idea.
That's a really neat idea to think that it still was buried there for so long and finally rose. But here, I don't know what their purpose is as far as what's going on and how they created things and how they fit in with everything else going on.
Well, but Matt, one other thing from this issue I wanted to draw your attention to was on page 9. And we get the caption with the name for the awkward-looking troubleshooter that we couldn't remember.
Simon Rodstelval.
Allegedly, that's his name. Yeah. But we also see him with his bikini top lit up. Does this look better or worse than when it's not lit up, is my question to you.
It looks a little better, although the eyes are still just, I don't know. This character design is
also lit up.
So weird. I just don't like the design. He kind of looks like one of the characters from Hellraiser, but with fire instead of
needles. It's interesting because they look on a different page, on page 14, when like Blue Marvel isolates him. It no longer looks like a bikini, and it's no longer lit up. It almost just looks like a tattoo.
It doesn't have that the same texture to it. But then, then his eyes don't look as bad, though, on page 15. They just look like they're hollowed out. It's not glasses.
Oh, yeah, which is also calls back to the look of the guy from the Beyond Corporation.
Yeah. Then you keep going, and then the dude looks like a big baby by the end of it.
He becomes a big, evil red.
This reference is going to be lost on Bob, but he literally looks like a Silent Hill thing, a monster from Silent Hill.
Interesting. Well, we move ahead to the cliffhanger here, Matt. In the cliffhanger, we have Logos reverts Galactus again.
Now, Bob, you said that was a cliffhanger. I think the cliffhanger is when Black Panther loses his entire outfit, but still gets to keep the undies. Apparently, his undies are made of the machine stuff.
He's got his briefs or his... I will, from here on out, instead of being referring to him as Black Panther, I will just refer to him as Speedo Panther.
It's pretty cool. I have to admit, he still puts up a fight, even when he doesn't have the cool...
And that also felt armor. Very Batman, right? Stripped down to just...
He's like, I'll still take you out. Don't worry. You end it, though, too, with this really cool image of Galactus saying, I hunger, and he's back to the purple, so he's going through some rough times right now.
He's going through some stuff. Well, Matt, that takes us to the page I wanted to talk about in issue number 5. I'm just skipping over the secret origin of Philip Nelson Vaught because it's not for me. But on page 8, we see Black Panther use a combination of Wakandan martial arts and Kunlun Iron Fist martial arts. And he uses this combination style to strike one of the troubleshooters in her third eye, her psychic third eye, which is what holds her armor together. And so it splits her armor. It's a cool moment.
It is an excellent moment and probably one of the better action sequences in these issues. I just love the idea that he just kicks her straight in the head. But you can tell the way they drew the foot, it vibrates. You can see where visually you can see it vibrating. And then her armor just falls apart, almost in the same way in the previous issue, the way Black Panther's armor fell apart.
It's a nice little parallel. She stripped him, he strips her, right?
Yep, but then they don't do anything after that. That's a sexual thing.
No, it's not a sexual thing. Then going into the cliffhanger for issue 5, Matt, I guess for context, you know, we saw in the first Ultimate series that Anti-Man was having visions of Eternity in chains, right? And all the other characters thought Anti-Man was crazy. This was the source of a lot of the action in the first Ultimate series that we covered. And here we get the reveal of who actually has chained Eternity, who actually is the Cosmic Jailer. And the Cosmic Jailer is the First Firmament. And we'll find out early in the next issue that the First Firmament actually created the First Universe and the Celestials, who then created subsequent universes.
And we're on the 8th right now. Is that where we're at?
Yeah, I think we're still on the 8th.
Okay.
Right?
So, this sets up that whole idea that, okay, this was the first part of.
I lost track of this. Galactus is from the 6th universe, and the pre-Secret War universe is the 7th. And then we now have confirmation that
this is the 8th.
This is the when Franklin and Molecule Man at the end of Secret Wars recreate the universe. They're not just recreating the 7th. It's actually a new 8th universe.
Yeah, that's it. That's the only way I could anchor what was going on with the first firmament by using that logic. I'm thinking that's right. So listeners, if we're wrong, I don't care because that's the only way I could make it work in my head.
Not only are we dealing with personified concepts and personified metaphors, we're dealing with personified universes. And I think basically the first firmament is God, right?
Like, that's my impression, yes. That's what I caught on to.
That's a nice little euphemism, so you don't have to call him God, but I think he's basically God. He's the Sky Father dog.
But he's got Eternity caged.
He's got Eternity caged.
And Anti-Man warned us in the last run.
I thought he was crazy. Well, Matt, to move into issue number 6, which is the last issue of the first trade of Ultimates 2, Volume 2. My guess at your favorite panel in issue number 6 is going to be pretty late in the issue. And on page 18, we see that selfsame Anti-Man, the man who first saw what First Firmament, what God was doing to Eternity. He gives up his life to give Galactus cosmic absolution. And this cosmic absolution returns Galactus to being the life bringer instead of the devourer.
Yeah, I was happy to see Anti-Man go. But then my favorite, though, Bob, is on page 19 when that baby creature that used to be Rostov or whatever,
that was pretending
to be Rostov or whatever, he was actually part of the first firmament, correct? He was an embodiment of
like
it.
Agent of it or
yeah, so Galactus literally picks him up and just eats him. He's devouring the evil.
To bring life.
Correct, Bob. That he's a good guy now. He eats bad things.
Yeah, he doesn't eat good things anymore. He just
eats worlds. He eats little fiery baby things that try to beat the Ultimates, yes.
So this issue brings the threat to a head, at least for now, right? So the first firmament is defeated for now. And yeah, we have Galactus back as the life bringer. Then it sort of ends with a funny cliffhanger because this is the end of this first arc of the series where Miss America is basically telling the Ultimates something worse is coming. So I'm going to college to get my mind open. I should do the same. And we're going to prepare for the title War in Heaven.
Here's where the book... You have to make there's a crossover that fit in here somewhere. And it threw me for a little bit of a loop. So
what do you mean? Do you mean
the next issue? Sorry, the next issue. Okay. Issue we're going into.
Okay. So let me do a little more transition.
All right, good.
Okay. So that ends our first trade, Troubleshooters. And now we're moving into the second and final trade of Ultimates 2, Volume 2, and the final trade of Ultimates Trade. This is Eternity War. This covers issues 7 through 9 and what would be issue 10, but is also the 100th issue of Ultimates. So it's Ultimates 100. And it's worth noting as a side thing, our artist for 7 and 8, 1 through 6 was Travel Foreman, and 9 and 100 will be Travel Foreman. But our artist for 7 and 8 is Odd Cock, who I'd never heard of. And
only done more Marvel comics.
Odd Cock has done these two issues.
Above.
Of Pat.
Odd Koch has done these two issues and did an issue of Miss America and did an issue of Vision. I don't think it's the Tom King Vision. I think it's a different Vision. Oh. That brings us into issue 7, which, Matt, as you were saying,
it's some tie-in that happens here that I got lost at the beginning because apparently Earth has a shield around it now.
Well,
or something.
So you know what the crossover is?
It's something to do with Captain America being Hydra. Is that my understanding?
Yeah, Empire.
Secret Empire.
Remember we were saying that Nick Spencer is a somewhat controversial writer. He's controversial for this crossover. This is the one where I don't know the actual mechanics of it, and I've never read it, so I can't comment on the substance of the controversy. But basically, Captain America has become a Hydra Captain America through alternate universes or something.
Yes, put up a shield around the Earth that now no one can get in and out of. So our characters are stuck in space. There is an oncoming invasion.
In her solo book at this time, Captain Marvel is the leader of Alpha Flight, which we saw reference at the end of the Hickman Secret Wars. And Alpha Flight is the first line of defense for humanity against alien threat. She's in this space station that we've seen in this Ultimate series, right? Then Hydra Captain America has tricked Captain Marvel into building a wall to protect the Earth. And then the reveal in this issue is this wall that a Nazi has tricked Captain America is being used to keep her. Yeah, you don't get that.
Bob, what is it? This sounds like it's something that was going on around 2017.
There's some parallels to events in 2017. Yeah. And so you have Captain Marvel and Monica and Blue Marvel out fighting the invasion with the Guardians of the Galaxy. But then they discover, because of the machinations of Hydra Cap, that they're trapped away from the Earth. And so my guess at your favorite panel, even though it presupposes all this crossover nonsense, was on page 13, where Rocket Raccoon is making fun of the Ultimates because they got banished from the Earth.
It's pretty hilarious. Yeah, I will admit that. Having the Guardians here, along with these super powerful characters of, you know, Carol Danvers, Blue Marvel, and Monica Rambeau all there, and then you've got Star-Lord, you know, like, okay. Good.
I don't know what's going on in Secret Empire, but I assume this is just a way to write out the cosmic characters for the duration of the crossover.
I'm sure there was some other tie-in issue here that just fit in with the Guardians of the Galaxy also having to protect the Earth, because once they leave, they're the only ones left.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what the Guardians of the Galaxy were up to at this period of time, and I think this was the era of the Gary Duggan run, and they were doing more cosmic stuff, but I don't know. I'm sure they were in the crossover in some capacity. Well, Matt, should I go ahead and go to the cliffhanger for issue number 7 of the tie-in issue?
Yeah, hit that cliffhanger, Bob.
All right, Matt. So we see Lifebringer Galactus chilling in Molecule Man's Outside the Universe clubhouse that we saw in the previous Ultimates.
And he's watching a TV with an antenna.
And Miss America has come to plea for Lifebringer Galactus to help the Earth, but Galactus says he can't. They made their decision, and he's choosing to leave the Ultimates in, cue title, Purgatory.
Oh, no. They're just out there. Chitauri coming down. Can't go back to their planet because they got locked out from the door they built themselves. So moving to the next issue.
This is not a tie-in issue, Matt. This is a Galactus issue.
Yeah, it's the Galactus issue.
And we had one or two, I think two Galactus issues in the first Ultimate series, right?
Yeah, and I love how it starts off with Galactus. But to give you the recap, he's laying down just like he was in the previous one. He's just chilling. Yeah. Here's what I'm seeing on my TV.
So is he watching TV or is he in therapy?
Especially on the next page where it looks like it's himself giving him, the way it's drawn, it does look like his former self. Galen is giving therapy, or is the therapist giving it to Galactus about what to do.
Well, and it's funny because on page 3 we're talking about here, usually in comics and usually in this comic, we've seen like flashbacks are drawn above the panel. But here, yeah, like you're saying, lying down Galactus is upside down at the top of the panel. Then his past self is the flashback is at the bottom of the page. It's a very playful inversion of the usual structure. Koch does a good art on this. My guess at your favorite panel, Matt, was going to be on page 7, where we reveal that Lifebringer Galactus got shrunk and he's walking on a planet, and we realize he's walking on Ego, the living planet. We have a huge splash page of Ego announcing himself, which is a cool splash page.
I do love the idea of him walking around inside the planet and finding the brain of the planet, just walking up to it.
As alluded to in this comic, Galactus and Ego is an old, old rivalry in Marvel. And then we see Galactus and Ego apologize to each other and explain their origins to each other. It's sweet.
Then we get Bob Ego Prime, who is Ego the living planet, but he has a body. Really want a weird example of what this would look like. Imagine Earth, but with a body.
Earth is the head.
Weird to think about.
Matt, had you ever heard of the Infinity Watch? The Eternity Watch. The Infinity Watch spins out of Infinity Gauntlet. Adam Warlock and a bunch of other characters who are goal is to safeguard the Infinity Gauntlet and to keep it from falling in the wrong hands. I haven't read a lot of Infinity Watch. One other bit of trivia is a lot of the members of the Infinity Watch become the movie Guardians of the Galaxy. In the late aughts, when Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning did their version of the Guardians of the Galaxy, they took a lot of the members, especially Drax and Gamora, are members of the Infinity Watch, and then they had them be part of the Guardians.
Here, Bob, in the Eternity Watch, you've got the Infinaut, who we met previously, so I'm glad they actually had an issue where we found out what he is.
Our first big cliffhanger here is Galactus, Lifebringer Galactus, introducing Ego Prime, the living planet, as the final member of the Eternity Watch.
So you got Ego Prime, Infinaut, you got the Ghost of the Shaper of Worlds.
Yeah, they call him Ghost Shaper or Ghost Shaper of the Worlds.
And then you have Psyhawk, who was introduced earlier too.
Brushed over.
Yeah, it happened.
Yeah. I like Psyhawk a lot better than the Infinaut, and I actually understand him. Psyhawk is like the living avatar of the source of the Troubleshooter's psychic powers.
Yes. That's where the Troubleshooters did play a role in this. Evolving it.
We talked about not getting the Infinaut last series, and I don't think I had a good explanation for you then, and I definitely don't have a good explanation for you now. All right, so that's only the first cliffhanger in this Ultimates 2, Volume 2, Number 8. The second cliffhanger is that we see the Maker, Ultimate Reed Richards, evil Ultimate Reed Richards, and the High Evolutionary are conspiring, and that leads us to Q title, Survivors.
What you think about the dog butler for Infinaut?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, we see the High Evolutionary has an upright dog butler, and is that cute or is that creepy, Matt?
I think it's kind of cute. It looks like Michael Goff Alfred from the Batman.
Oh, he does, doesn't he? Yeah.
Just as a dog.
With the glasses way far down his snout. I'm going to say it's both cute and creepy.
I wouldn't want one myself, but if you're the High Evolutionary, that's the stuff he does.
I put up with enough crap from my cat if she were engineered to be my servant.
All right, Bob. I want to start the next issue, if you don't mind, with the recap. And I'm just going to read it so that everyone can hear what you have to understand to get to this final to the final issues. Are you ready?
Read away.
I am the Never Queen. I am what might be. Forever outside, what is from here I see all. And at this point, all is a lot. First, there were the Ultimates, formed by Carol Danvers, to solve cosmic problems before they became problems. They solved the problem of Galactus, the World Eater, by evolving him into the true role as Lifebringer. But on a later mission, Galactus and the Ultimates discovered that Eternity, he who is the multiverse, was in chains. Recently, they discovered the name of Eternity's cosmic jailer, the First Firmament, first iteration of all reality, a universe unto himself. The First Firmament, it is said, created the Celestials, who rebelled against him, destroying part of him to create the first multiverse, which evolved into Eternity as we know him today. First Firmament was never forgiven Eternity or the Celestials, and neither have his loyal servants, the Dark Celestials, known as Aspirants. The Aspirants infected Eternity, corrupting one of the central processes ordering chaos to create Logos, the law unto itself. Logos has executed the Celestials and attempted to destroy Galactus, but the Lightbringer survived and formed a ragtag posse of fellow cosmic-level entities, the Eternity Watch. Thus, the Eternity War has begun, but Galactus' allies, the Ultimates, are busy with the secret empire of Hydra, which has sealed off the Earth. And on Counter-Earth, the alternate Reed Richards, known as the Maker, has entered the war as a third faction, working with the mysterious High Evolutionary to evolve the entire cosmos.
Yeah, it's just simple.
It's so simple, Bob. It sounds like the Bible.
Yeah, it does sound like the Bible. Maybe even more Milton's Paradise Lost. I didn't know that your favorite panel would be the recap, although I should have because you texted me. But my guess at your favorite panel was on page 6, where we see Lifebringer Galactus and Eternity Watch kick down the door on Logos and the firmament. They're interstellar cops or conceptual cops.
It literally does it with his foot. But keep in mind, Bob, it's a metaphor.
It's a metaphor.
He's not really kicking the door in, Bob. He's a metaphor.
And this brings us to a fight beyond all imagining. While this is happening, we have the High Evolutionary feel betrayed by the Maker because he feels like the Maker isn't evolving the cosmos. He's just making it static. Then we have the Ultimates still fighting the Chitauri. And then I got to a page I wanted to flag for you, Matt, on 13, because I wondered if this made you nostalgic. So we see Black Panther T'Challa going into the bowels of his necropolis to fight the Tiger God, White Tiger. And I wondered, did that make you nostalgic for both Hickman's New Avengers and Ewing's Mighty Avengers?
It did.
Well, Matt, in our cliffhanger, which is not in the bowels of the necropolis, but has been brought in by the Maker as reinforcements to hold up his static vision of the new universe, no longer a multiverse, just a single universe. He brings in, Matt, we've been reading about the all-new Ultimates, but Maker brings back his old colleagues from the Ultimate Universe, the all-old Ultimates. To prevent the High Evolutionary from resetting the Maker, resetting the multiverse into a universe, which leads us to cue the title, In Formation. And that's in space formation, not information, one word, in space formation.
And you've got all this crazy cosmic stuff going on, and then the Maker brings back the original Ultimates from the first Ultimate run back in, I guess, God, it put 2001, 2, somewhere
yeah,
there.
Yeah, thereabouts.
Yes. Yeah. So if you have no familiarity with these characters, I'm sorry, you were probably lost, but it is cool to see them back. And it also reminds me of the different art design and the different way the characters portrayed in that run. Because the Hulk himself, that the way he's depicted is so different. You can just look at it and be like, oh yeah, that was that Hulk, the one that eats the Wasp.
This brings us into issue number 100, Garden of Ideas. And definitely, since this is the 100th issue of the Ultimates, in some way, it's like the 100th issue of X-Men, right? The all-new X-Men have to fight the robot duplicates of the original five, which then leads into Jean becoming the Phoenix.
Right.
And it's that idea. So you have to bring back the old Ultimates for Ultimates 100. But Ewing is obviously satirical and critical of the old Ultimates. In a way, he's doing what's there, but he's playing the violence and the ridiculousness of the early aughts Ultimates, right?
Right.
And so, Matt, I don't know. I felt maybe your favorite panels were all fight scenes between the all-new Ultimates and the old Ultimates. And especially it's when the all-new Ultimates get one over on the old Ultimates. So on page 8, we have Blue Marvel slugging Ultimate Hulk. Then on page 11, we have Captain Marvel slugging Ultimate Giant Man. One of those might be your favorite panel.
Yeah, I really did like to see Blue Marvel just giving an uppercut to the Ultimate Hulk here.
Matt thinks when Galactus eats things, that's cool. He does not think it's cool when Ultimate Hulk eats things.
When he eats the Wasp, it's just not as cool.
Yeah, Al Ewing really likes the Wasp.
Do you remember, Bob, that the Tony Stark in the Ultimate Universe runs off alcohol for real?
I did not remember that, but that was funny to see.
You've forgotten about that. I think I read the first trade, maybe, of that series back when.
I definitely didn't keep going after that. I think I read the first two trades. Well, Matt, I had a couple of other guesses at what might be your favorite panel. One was on page 20, where Black Panther comes back riding the Tiger God, which was something you caught the foreshadowing of. And the thing I like is, we maybe mentioned this when we were talking about Logos earlier in the comic. Logos looks like a crown. And basically, Black Panther has the Tiger God put the crown on of Logos.
It really does. The crown is amazing. If you look very closely, you can see that the gold part of it, the crown is pieced together by a Living Tribunal. Thought that was neat.
Yeah,
if you look at it.
Makes sense.
And it's really weird, too, because when he does put it on, he pulls it apart and you can see what's inside the crown. And you see Chaos and Order like shoved up in there.
Like all jammed together in Logos.
Yeah, Logos is like some plastic baggie.
That was a really neat moment. And then my other guess at your favorite. So, yeah, there's been a kind of funny, ironic escalation.
Right.
Okay, the Ultimates are already this overpowered superhero team.
But now Black Panther also, because he's got the super Tiger God thing he can control.
Then you had Galactus's Ultimates, his Eternity Watch, right? So Galactus
Correct.
Had already done a ridiculous superhero team. Then now you see the apex of that. You see Eternity assemble his Ultimates, who are basically all the embodiments of different universes, right?
Yeah.
We're missing the fourth, but we have the embodiments of the other five universes to come fight the first universe, the first firmament.
It's insane. It lost me a little there, but I got the concept. I'm not familiar. Are these new characters or we've never seen these before?
New characters.
Okay, so that's where I run into problems. Sometimes I don't know. Sometimes they look like other characters we've seen in the past.
They might have resonances in other Marvel cosmic stuff that I'm unfamiliar with. And I think the missing fourth one will turn out to be a cosmic aspect people know, although I forget who. But no, in general, I think these are like new characters. And granted, the idea of this being the seventh or eighth Marvel universe, that's a known quantity in Marvel Cosmics already. But I think this is Ewing running with that known idea into this deeply personified and superheroized direction.
I will say there is something very disturbing on page 27 when Ego drops his body.
Last, a planet again.
So, Bob, in the end of this, Galactus doesn't go back to his devourer form. He stays the Lifebringer. And there is some text at the end when Ewing originally pitched this, Galactus was going to return to the status quo, but he decided against it because we've already seen all that. And I thought that was interesting. We do know he eventually does go back to it at some point.
Yeah, he goes back in about 6 months or a year after this. I'd kind of assumed that a Galactus would reset, but it's very interesting that Ewing declines to reset it. I was just skimming Ewing's farewell message, and it is interesting that he talks about the influence of the Mark Waid Heaven issue in Fantastic Four.
Yes.
That we read a while back on this, which, yeah, that's an interesting connection too. Well, Matt, any other thoughts about Ultimates 2 or Ultimates 2 in conversation with Ultimates Omniversal, the one we just read?
Yeah, I've got to say, Bob, I really did enjoy both runs. I think this is one of Ewing's strongest work.
I like Mighty Avengers a lot more than you, but yeah, this is definitely operating on a much higher level than Mighty Avengers. And it goes in a different direction in this series than in the first series. But in the first series, it did really feel the true heir to Hickman's New Avengers and the universe-level storytelling that Ewing was doing, right?
Right. And once again, I would have been actually absolutely fascinated if he would not have had to have tied it in with whatever was going on with Hydra Captain America.
I really enjoy the cheap shots on the Ultimates. They're not even cheap shots because that's just what the original Ultimates were.
Right.
So it's not even cheap shots in that sense. In terms of ranking, I was going to propose that I think we agree that it goes Hickman's Avengers run and then the Ewing Ultimates run.
Yes.
And I was not sure before rereading this because I really like Hickman's Aliens versus Avengers. But I know you're not as big a fan of Hickman's Aliens versus Avengers. And upon reading this right after that, I think this is better than Hickman's Aliens.
It is, for sure. I agree.
Which also puts it above Paul Dini's two Detective Comics and Streets of Gotham runs, which I wasn't sure if you would be okay
with. I'm fine with that. I think this is actually really good compared to, I'm not going to argue with that one. So you're thinking below City of Madness?
Yeah. So on our 28 item list, soon to be 29, I was thinking that both series of Al Ewing's Ultimates could be number 9 after Batman City of Madness. And that's also got art by Christian Ward. And I think, even though I love the art that Christian Ward and Travel Foreman do in Ultimates, I think Christian Ward's art in City of Madness is on another level and just is above the art on this. If that makes
sense. It truly is.
All right, we'll put in both Ultimate series by Al Ewing as the new number 9 on our now 29 item list. And listeners, join us next week.
Right.
Well, have a good night, everyone. I'm Bob in Cascadia. That's Matt in the Southland.
Thanks for listening.